for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. It was the Democrats' fault. It was the Republicans' fault. It was Grover Norquist's fault. The blame game in Washington began even before the Deficit Supercommittee announced its failure to come to agreement. Joining me here in the studio to talk about what it means and what's next, Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal, and former Republican Congressman Robert Walker of Pennsylvania. Before we begin our discussion here in the studio, joining us by phone is Maryland Democrat Chris Van Hollen. We invited Democratic and Republican members of the Super Committee to join today's program. Congressman Van Hollen was the only one to accept. Good morning, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane.
Congressman Van Hollen, in your view, why was the Super Committee unable to come up with a plan that everyone on the committee could support?
Well, first, Diane, let me say I'm very disappointed that we were unable to reach an agreement. I think it was a huge missed opportunity for the country. And the easy storyline will be, as you said at the beginning of the program, that you know both sides refused to compromise, no one refused to budge, and every time one of us tries to explain what happened, we'll be accused of political finger-pointing. What I would ask people to do is look at the proposals that were advanced compared to other bipartisan groups like Simpson-Bowles. And what the Democrats said from the beginning is that we wanted a plan that was balanced. We understand that we need to make difficult cuts, and we proposed many difficult cuts, including the Medicare and Medicaid reforms proposed in Simpson-Bowles. But we also insisted that there be balance, and we asked that folks at the very high end of the income scale participate in deficit reduction, as did the Simpson-Bowles Commission. Unfortunately, our colleagues refused to budge on that and insisted that we extend almost all of the Bush tax cuts that disproportionately benefit the wealthy at the same time that they were talking about asking Medicare recipients at $23,000 annual income to pay a lot more. We didn't think that was fair.
Do you feel that the panel put in enough hours to try to get to a deal, considering the fact that, at least as I understand it, you didn't meet face-to-face very many times?
Well, I do think that the panel put in the necessary time. I don't think the time invested was the issue. Speaking for myself, I was working 24/7 on this issue.
Meeting with?
While there weren't that many meetings of the full group of 12, there were a lot of meetings of subgroups and other members trying to reach a solution, trying to find a way.
So what do you think President Obama's options are now?
Well, I think the president is very right to say that he will veto any effort to undo sequester, because that's just an effort to do an end run on deficit reduction. And those who propose to totally undo the sequester are clearly not serious about deficit reduction, because the result would be an immediate $1.2 trillion increase in the deficit. And the whole purpose of the Super Committee was to confront the other choices for getting that kind of deficit reduction and to try and do it in a balanced way, as other bipartisan groups had done.
Finally, Congressman Van Hollen, we're coming up to the Thanksgiving holiday. You, your fellow members of Congress, are all going home. You're going to see constituents. I will tell you that people are mad as hell. How are you going to deal with that?
As they should be, Diane. And look, I share their frustration. The best I can do is to ask people to take a thorough look at the record of these negotiations. And I think that record will come out in the days ahead, and measure what Democrats and Republicans were proposing against the standard of other bipartisan commissions. Because I know that by the standard of Simpson-Bowles, for example, the Democratic plan was very balanced. And in fact, nonpartisan outside groups properly said that the Democratic proposal was to the right of Simpson-Bowles when they looked at the ratio of cuts to revenue, when they looked at the willingness to reform Medicare and Medicaid. Now, let me be clear. We were not willing to accept the Republican budget proposal to totally end the Medicare guarantee, as they proposed in their budget, which would force seniors out of the Medicare program into the private insurance market without adequate support. But what we were willing to do was to incorporate every reform concept for Medicare and Medicaid that was in Simpson-Bowles, a bipartisan group. But we did ask our Republican colleagues to do what Simpson-Bowles did and ask for the wealthiest Americans to go back to paying the same amount that they would be paying under the old Clinton tax rates. It didn't have to be at the same rates necessarily, but the same amount. And the answer came back no.
Maryland Democratic Congressman Chris Van Hollen, thanks for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
And turning to you now, Congressman Bob Walker. So this
former
Congressman Bob Walker. I still feel you deserve that title.
Oh, I keep the title, none of the power, but
absolutely.
I keep the title.
He may not want it, Diane.
Yeah. Okay. So you are clearly blaming the Democrats. Tell me why.
Well, I blame the process. In my view, the whole idea of the super committee was a failure of the entire process.
Why?
Well, because we have processes for taking care of budget and appropriations issues for deficit. It's called the Budget Act of 1974. Both houses of Congress are supposed to pass a budget. They are supposed to then reconcile those budgets, and then there's a reconciliation process by which we move forward on budgets.
So
that process has totally broken down. It's a scandal that the fact that Congress cannot get its work done, that Congress can't do this. The House at the beginning of this year passed a budget. It was not an easy thing to do for them, but they passed a budget. The Senate has not passed a budget for nearly 3 years now. You can't in any way put together the budget process and make it work if all you're doing is going off for gimmicks like super committees.
Nort Morenstein, you see this as a totally missed opportunity.
Oh, there's no question it was a totally missed opportunity. I have a lot of sympathy with what Bob said. I am a strong defender, as he is, of the regular order. I wish we had done a deficit reduction deal using the regular order. I wish that they had a different set of rules for the Simpson-Bowles Commission from the beginning would have had, as the supercommittee did, just a majority, because a majority supported it, and have it come up for a vote. But along the way, here's the missed opportunity, Diane. Every outside group, Simpson-Bowles is one. The Bipartisan Policy Center's Rivlin-Domenici Commission is another. The informal Gang of Six in the Senate is a third. The negotiations between Speaker Boehner and the president are a fourth. They all had roughly, and even more than roughly, the same template. $4 trillion in deficit reduction over 10 years. It was $1 trillion in revenues under Simpson-Bowles, $1.3 trillion in Rivlin-Domenici, $1.5 trillion in the Gang of Six, $800 billion with Boehner-Obama, all coupled with tax reform, and then another trillion at least from a reform of entitlement programs. You had that on the table. You had a super committee that had unparalleled powers. Whatever they came up with, up or down vote, no delays in both houses, and they couldn't do this kind of a deal despite the fact that, and I believe Van Hollen is right, what they had put on the table was the set of Medicare and Medicaid reforms that were in Simpson-Bowles.
Naftali Ben-David, in practical terms, what does this mean, failing to reach a deal?
Well, what it means in practical terms is that in January of 2013, there's a series of cuts that are supposed to take effect, totaling $1.2 trillion, but half of them from defense and half of them from domestic programs. I mean, I think what it's really going to mean is that Congress is going to be under a tremendous amount of pressure before that time to come up with another $1.2 trillion package of deficit cuts, because the cuts that would go into effect in January 2013 are pretty damaging, I think, and to both sides, both domestic and military. What it turned out is that the bomb, if you will, for the committee wasn't scary enough. In other words, you know, in the previous budget talks, we had the possibility of default and economic cataclysm. Before that, we had the threat of a government shutdown. The threat that, well, in a year, the same amount of cuts would go into effect wasn't enough to prompt action. And Congress these days seems to need that kind of a crisis. But I think they are going to be under a lot of pressure to do it in the next year, but they're not going to have the protections that the committee did have. It would have to take, for example, 61 votes in the Senate.
Former Congressman Walker, I want to ask you about something David Brooks wrote this morning. We may not be able to get all your answers before the break, but he wrote, Grover Norquist's tax pledge isn't really about tax policy. It's a chastity belt Republican politicians wear to show that they have not been defiled by the Washington culture. Short break, and we'll be right back. And we're back. Congressman Walker, would you like me to read that quote to you again?
No, I heard it, and my reaction was that the fact that there are any chastity belts at all on Capitol Hill is probably a surprise to the American people. But the fact is that Republicans do philosophically believe that government is too big and spends too much, and that what tax packages are designed to do is to give the government more revenue so it can spend even more. That has been a longstanding policy of the Republican Party. And so, therefore, if there are going to be any kinds of revenue changes, and particularly revenue enhancements, the Republicans believe that they have to be accompanied by massive spending cuts so that what we're doing is actually dealing with the deficit and not simply feeding the beast with more revenue.
Did you hear what Congressman Van Hollen said about Democrats' willingness to cut Medicare and Medicaid if Republicans express some willingness in raising some taxes?
Well, his view of that is somewhat different from the Republicans on the committee, who believe that the Democrats never fielded a proposal that they all agreed upon. The Republicans were prepared to put a definite proposal on the table that they were all agreed upon as a place to begin negotiations. And while there were floats of proposals from Democrats, including Max Baucus. There was never a proposal that they were agreed upon so that they could come to the table and negotiate. That ended up being a part of the problem. Once again, the super committee, because of that kind of setup, was a bad idea from the outset.
Naftali.
Yeah, I've heard other Republicans make that point. I can only tell you what the Democrats say, which is that, you know, the fact that they didn't get a sign-off from every single one of their members shouldn't be taken for not presenting a pretty serious proposal. There was one that Patty Murray made to Jeb Hensarling. There were others that Max Baucus and Dave Camp were talking about. Not representing the Democrats, obviously, but what they would say is, that's true, we didn't get everybody to sign on the dotted line, but it doesn't mean that we didn't make some very serious proposals.
No.
You know, there were, if you look at what proposals were formally on the table, and Ezra Klein in the Washington Post, I thought, had a pretty good template for this. You look at the deal that Boehner and Obama were close to getting, and from that, Democrats put concrete proposals that moved right. And these were proposals that Max Baucus, John Kerry, Patty Murray, and Chris Van Hollen, at least, and Javier Becerra very likely as well, were willing to sign on to that were, in fact, very much like the Simpson-Bowles plans on Medicare and Medicaid. And Republicans, as the Democrats moved right from the Obama plan and moved down in revenues from Simpson-Bowles, Republicans moved further right. The only plan of revenues put on the table, and that was true even privately, was the Pat Toomey plan almost at the end of this process. And that was a plan for $300 billion, mostly in fees, not in tax increases. And in return for that, reducing the top marginal rate from the current level under the Bush tax cuts of 36% to 28% and extending permanently all the Bush tax cuts. So it's a deal that says we'll take $300 billion in new revenue for $3.7 trillion in revenue cuts. To me, it doesn't look like an even process here.
Congressman Walker.
Well, so insofar as you want to use the Simpson-Bowles template, the fact is that the administration appointed that commission, and then when they reported, said thank you and ignored the whole thing. And so there's no faith whatsoever among Republicans that the administration wouldn't go out and do the same thing that they did to the Republican budget when it passed the House of Representatives, and that is go out and hammer people for actually having the courage to stand up and take real policy positions. This administration did not move that forward. Had the administration pushed forward the Simpson-Bowles plan, we might well have had some leadership that the Congress then would have followed. They didn't do that. And as a matter of fact, the president then walked away from the whole supercommittee process, called a couple of people on the phone a couple of times to say, good luck, guys. And so on. It got nothing in terms of leadership.
Naftali.
I mean, I think this is the kind of back and forth that we heard throughout the process. And it really struck me the extent to which there was distrust and polarization. To my mind, both sides did put forth proposals that actually did cross some lines that they hadn't previously been willing to cross. But instead of the other side saying, good, you've shifted your position, what they said is, well, you're still so far from where we would ever be that I don't take this in good faith. And the other striking thing to me was, and this has been a problem that's bedeviled Congress, I think, all year, which is a lack of leaders who can deliver followers so that they can say, okay, let's agree to this deal, and then I know that my guys are going to vote for it. We'll all step out on a limb, but we'll do it together. And this seemed to me like a leaderless process. It was hard to tell on the Republican side, was it Jeb Hensarling? Was it Pat Toomey? Was it John Boehner? And the Democrats had kind of a similar lack of clarity as to who was kind of leading the thing. And I think that was a big part of the problem.
And what happened to President Obama?
You know, I fault President Obama significantly for not, at his State of the Union message a year past, embracing the Simpson-Bowles, at least in concept. But I also have to say this, Diane. When the president embraced the Gang of Six plan, Politico quoted a senior aide to Mitch McConnell as saying, well, that's the end of that. If he's for it, we're against it. And the fact is that Obama, in this case, I think was wise politically to stay out of this process because anything that would have looked as if this were an Obama triumph would have hardened those partisan lines at the time of a permanent campaign.
Naftali, as a reporter, did you hear what Norm heard?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that had the White House stepped in, and I know a lot of Republicans were calling for this, and there's a certain logic to presidential leadership in these situations, clearly, but I think there was a certain fear that it would lead to a hardening of positions. And there's been, since it's happened, there's been a certain amount of talk from Republicans that President Obama wanted this to fail. I don't think there's necessarily evidence for that. I do think there's a way in which it plays into his strategy, his campaign strategy of running against a do-nothing Congress. He kept his distance. His fingerprints are not on the failure of this committee in any sort of an obvious way, and it's one more example of congressional failure.
Here's an email from Bill in Chapel Hill, who says, so even in a small committee with nearly all procedural impediments to bringing a vote removed, the Deficit Reduction Committee has failed, unable to put forth any proposal. It's time to start electing our representatives not on their positions, but on their reasonableness, with a view toward governing rather than advancing any partisan position. To paraphrase Shakespeare, our faults, dear citizens, are not in our representatives, but in ourselves. Congressman Walker.
Well, look. The fact is that both parties have failed in the art of governing. The Republicans shut down the process when they were in control of the House back in the early part of this century. Nancy Pelosi, when she was Speaker, shut down the process even more. Boehner, to his credit, has been trying to open up the process some. The fact is that regular order in the Congress has been abandoned. The idea that somehow that you will move this thing down to 12 people making the decision for everybody else is just a bad idea. I mean, if the super committee didn't work, is the next gimmick the super duper committee? I mean, in the end here, you don't have a process that is working. The way to make the process work is to use the budget process that's now in law, and that is not happening.
It's interesting that you say both have failed in the art of governing, or has the system failed?
Well, the system, though, is based all the way back to Jefferson's manual, and it was designed so that you would have a process by which people would come together. You would come together first in subcommittees and then in committees and work your way through each of the houses and so on. And you would find the mutual understandings through that process. We don't allow that process to work anymore. But the authorization process is totally broken down. The budget process is totally broken down. And the appropriations process has now become one huge bill that's passed every year, which is an abdication of responsibility, in my
Norm,
opinion.
If you've got one part of the political process absolutely determined not to raise taxes, that they've signed this pledge, how does anything move from that?
Well, that gets to the crux of the problem, and I think what the caller said as well, Diane. We now have parliamentary parties. They are cohesive and unified, and that's particularly true of the Republican as a minority party. You cannot have parliamentary parties operating in a non-parliamentary system, especially when there is divided government. Even when there's united government, you know, the 111th Congress was enormously productive, but we don't have a parliamentary culture. So when a majority acts on its own and the minority is in staunch opposition, the policy outputs are viewed as illegitimate by half the system. The bigger problem now, though, is not, I think, a process one. And I'm with Bob that we've had a process failure. But what's happened is we are dominated by the extremes. They're the ones nominating the candidates. They're the ones, look at the Republican presidential candidates, all gravitating away from what polls tell us is where the critical mass of Republicans overall are, because it's the activist voters. We are electing people or gravitating towards people who don't believe in the art of compromise. They're saying, I'm not like any of the rest of them. I've got nothing to do with Washington. I've got nothing to do with politics. And we're basically leeching out the politicians, those who believe in process and in compromise. Bob Walker is a very strong conservative. As a member of Congress, he was a politician. It shouldn't be a term of derogation. It should be a term we venerate. And now I fear that what's going to happen in 2012 is the disgust that Americans have, congressional approval may go down from its 9% now, is we're going to continue to look towards the Herman Cain type candidates for Congress and elsewhere and end up with even fewer people who respect the regular order, the legislative process, or compromise.
Naftali.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is interesting the disgust and the disdain in which Congress is held. And you see that over and over again in the polls. And members of Congress are very aware of it. I mean, they were very keenly aware during this process that should they fail, if they could go lower, they would go lower. But at the same time, who elects these people? I mean, I think we that's why I understand what the listener was saying. I mean, these are people we elected. It's because the electorate responds to fiery campaigners who say Washington is completely messed up either in one direction or the other, and it needs people who are going to burn the place down. And so we've elected people from both sides who have that kind of message, and they get here, and then it's very difficult to achieve anything. And so people say they want reasonableness and compromise, but it's repeatedly not who we've elected recently.
Naftali, where do we go from here?
Well, I think, as I said, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure in the next year to come up with $1.2 trillion in deficit cuts that the committee failed to do. Because if we don't, then in January 2013, there are going to be significant cuts to the military. I mean, the first year, there'd be like a 10% cut to the military budget. That's a lot. But there'd also be very significant cuts to discretionary programs. And, you know, Congress doesn't function unless there's a huge cataclysm right around the corner. And that cataclysm would be in January 2013. So my sense is in the next year, one way or another, they're going to have to come together and come up with something that the super committee couldn't do.
Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go to the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Bill.
Hello. Thanks very much. I think, and you've already addressed part of the issue that I wanted to speak about, but my question is about the reporting of this whole issue, and you, Diane, and a couple of the commentators really addressed it in a way. But every time I hear the news, every hour, NPR News or anyone else, I always hear quotes from different sides. Maybe I hear Jeff Sessions or Mitch McConnell, and then I hear the president or another Democrat. It seems to me that as reporters, what I should hear is a balanced assessment of what happened. And you gave that a minute ago when you said, what is it that happened? Well, each side, the Democrats started not wanting to compromise on spending. The Republicans started not wanting to compromise on tax cuts. The Democrats, seems to me, maybe I'm wrong, seems to me the Democrats gave some and were willing to compromise on making spending cuts. But I didn't see any, even the slightest compromise of a millimeter from the Republicans on any sort of revenue increases.
Is that true, Bob Walker?
Well, what the Republicans said was that what you don't want to do is raise taxes in the middle of a recession. They also said that tax increases will inevitably result in job losses. What we can't afford as a country right now is to move the unemployment rates up even more. And so, therefore, what we needed to do was reform the tax structure as a way of bringing in new revenues rather than raising tax rates. And in the Toomey plan that Noor mentioned a little bit ago, they did, in fact, put on the table a series of major changes in the tax code so that special interest loopholes could be eliminated and the revenues could be increased through tax reform rather than tax increases.
Well, to address the caller's point, though, I understand his frustration that, you know, you turn on the news and you hear the Republicans saying something and the Democrats saying something, and it sounds like they're on different planets. It doesn't even sound like the events that they were occurring are the same, describing are the same events. And I think we in the media do have a responsibility to try to cut through some of that. It's particularly difficult, though, in this kind of situation where so much of what happened was behind closed doors. And in a more of a situation than I've ever seen, the two sides would come out and give completely differing account of what had just happened. I mean, there were some moments when it was hard to know, frankly, what to write, because you would talk to one side and the other side, and they couldn't even agree on what it was they disagreed on. So I sympathize with the caller, and this is a story where I think that was particularly true.
Bill in Dallas said his understanding was that the Democrats had put forth a plan to compromise, but that Republicans were unwilling to compromise. Yes or no, Norm?
Well, once again, let me go back to what Ezra Klein put out there as the template. And from where we had compromises before, Democrats moved right and Republicans actually moved a little bit further right. You know, what Bob said about on the tax front, nobody was proposing tax increases now. And Republicans who said and continue to say you don't raise taxes in the middle of a recession because that would damage the economy weren't saying, well, you don't cut spending in the middle of a recession. They're all for cutting the spending. So I don't accept that as a legitimate argument. I think it's trying to change the subject from where we otherwise would be. And I might note, Diane, that you've got people like David Stockman, Rinesh Panuru, Steve Hayward, and David Frum, who all look at this, don't touch taxes. You know, everybody wants to see tax reform now, and that was on the table, as something that is moving away from what they view as the Republican Party's position and what it ought to be.
Well, just to be clear, I mean, Republicans do believe that spending by government, in fact, undermines the economy in many instances, and that the government has grown too big, that it's now taking 25% of the overall GDP. And we do believe that cutting spending as opposed to raising taxes, both of those things contribute to economic growth. Economic growth results when you move the government out of the economy and move the more private industry into it.
Bob Walker, former Republican congressman from Pennsylvania. He's chairman of Wexler and Walker Public Policy Associates. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. By EBSCO, supporting libraries with electronic resource discovery and management solutions, journal subscriptions, and EBSCO host databases. And by the Doris Duke Foundation for Islamic Art, seeking to improve Americans' understanding of Muslim arts and cultures. This is NPR.
New research indicates removing old cells can prevent age-related disease. Understanding the biology of aging and what genetically based treatments can mean for human health. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And here's an email from Virginia who says, this is all about job one, getting rid of Obama by maintaining a lousy economy, and the rest of us are collateral damage. What do you think, Norm?
I actually think that this thesis that Obama wanted the super committee to fail so that he could go out there and pursue his theme against a do-nothing Congress is pretty ridiculous. The theme that Obama's pursuing is not his first choice. His first choice would be it's morning in America. And indeed, anything that would provide some notion that things were working and that might get an economy that's very sluggish right now moving back on track would be positive for the president. What's going to be interesting as we look ahead is what kind of assessment will members of Congress make now, including the Republican members of Congress? They're going to go back home for Thanksgiving.
Right.
And as you said, Diane, they're mad as hell. Some members of Congress are going to get the message from their constituents, you get back there and solve this problem. Others are going to get the message from their constituents, if you raise a dime in taxes, we're going to primary you out of office. And so this may harden those views. If you get with a 9% approval rating, which, you know, John McCain is fond of saying leaves Congress with blood relatives and paid staff, and I'm not even sure about the blood relatives anymore, moving down, if more incumbents believe that, unlike the past, this is one where they might get thrown out if they don't begin to solve problems, we may see an impetus in 2012 to get something done. But because this is a primary-driven process, it could actually create an even bigger problem, a gulf, in terms of getting it accomplished.
All right, to Fort Myers,
well,
Florida.
Can I
surely
respond?
Surely, go right ahead.
Because, I mean, I think it is important to say that President Obama's campaign that is specifically determined to divide the country into us versus them is, in fact, underpinning a lot of the political discussion and our inability to move forward. And so I think that we do need to have some understanding that by dividing the country and understand and suggesting that we're not all 100% Americans is just, I think, detrimental to the whole political process.
Naftali.
Well, obviously, both sides thinks it's the other that's dividing the country and saying that they're not American. I think there's been a lot of that going around, unfortunately. But I also think we're not going to really have to wait until next year or late next year before these things erupt again. The current spending measure funding the government is going to expire on December 18th. There's a talk about whether or not we extend the current payroll tax holiday. There's talk about extending unemployment benefits. There's a lot of stuff that Congress was hoping the supercommittee would kind of take care of, but instead Congress is going to have to deal with when they get back over the next few weeks.
They're going to have to do their job.
And they're going to have to do it fast and intensively,
All right.
I think we're not going to have a lot of time to wait before it gets ugly again.
Let's take a call from Fort Myers, Florida. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very interested in the subject of the show. One of the things that has frustrated me watching the media and the coverage of this, first and foremost, is whenever the left talks about raising taxes on the wealthy among us, they're basically advocating discrimination. We got half the country paying no federal income taxes. We've got the rich paying a higher income tax rate than the rest of the world, than the rest of the country already. And yet we're so, and that is fundamentally discrimination. I don't know where we got the idea that it's, where we figured out as a country it's wrong to discriminate by race, but for some reason it's okay to discriminate by class. That blows my mind.
Interesting perspective. What do you think, Naftali?
Well, I mean, obviously, we've had policies in this country for a long time that take into account people's income and assets, and the idea that that's inherently discrimination is, I think, a novel idea. I mean, people do talk about flat taxes, of course, and so forth. But to me, discrimination is a pretty inflammatory term. It's usually described to talk about racial discrimination or religious discrimination. And to apply it to a policy that takes into account differences in people's situation economically, even if you agree with them or disagree with them, strikes me as a fairly strongly worded way to put it.
And class warfare is the other term that's been used.
Well, I do find it striking. And here again, Ramesh Panuru of the National Review wrote about this notion of the 47% who pay no federal income taxes. The main, you've got the elderly and the working poor, and they pay no income taxes mostly because of Republican proposals over many years to have an earned income tax credit and expand it. And those people pay a lot in taxes. They pay payroll taxes. They pay sales taxes. As a share of their income, it's higher than that of those at the very top. And while it's true that those at the very top have paid a higher proportion of the taxes, their incomes have gone up much, much more. And the level of inequality has been much sharper than we've ever seen in this society over the last 5 or 10 years.
Congressman Walker.
Well, clearly, I agree that the word discrimination may not be exactly the right term, but class warfare is certainly the right term. I mean, there are people who think for their political purposes that dividing this country into classes is, in fact, to their advantage. And I find that extremely disturbing. Now, in terms of the whole tax policy and so on, I think we would be better off moving to a flatter tax kind of situation. I happen to think that consumption taxes might be a way of going if, in fact, we eliminate all the income taxes as a part of moving to a consumption tax. There are some proposals out there that will make us vastly more competitive in a global economy than the tax system that we have right now. What we ought to be looking at is whether or not, as a nation, we are going to continue to lead the world economically, or whether or not we're going to drop behind the world. One of the things that is preventing us from being a leader economically is a tax system that is badly, badly out of control.
Let's go to O'Fallon, Illinois. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning, Ms. Ream. I'm a tremendous fan, and thank you for having me. And more importantly, thank you for having these frank discussions about what's happening
with our
congressional representatives and the budget right now. I have to say, you know, my current representative, Jerry Costello, has announced he's not running anymore. And he's not running because he cannot handle the dysfunction in Washington. And I am frustrated as a voter because I have elected representatives to represent me to compromise. And I really do believe that there are many representatives and senators who are doing just that. But the fact is that the right continues to raise the bar and move the line in the sand, no matter how many times the Democrats or the progressives come up to an agreement. I am very resentful that everyone continues to blame the president for this issue as far as the failure of the super committee, because I truly believe that the super committee was put in place by the representatives in Congress to do a job that they would not do. And the representatives did not do that job, and the president stayed out of it because every time, whether he's in the fight or he's out of the fight, he's getting such rhetoric abusing him for not, whether he's involved, he gets abused, or he's not involved, he gets abused.
Congressman Walker.
Well, the fact is that the process can be made to work. A decade and a half ago, we were able to balance budgets. We were able to reform entitlement programs. We were able to pass tax changes that increased economic growth. We did it with a Democrat in the White House and Republicans on Capitol Hill. We were able to work through all of that.
So what's different now?
Well, what's different now is that during the early part of the of this century, the process broke down in major ways, and I blame some of the leadership in the Congress among the Republicans for that breakdown, because I think what happened was that they decided that they could use the appropriations process to take care of their friends, and that played itself out in perverse ways. I believe that that was expanded upon by the Democrats when they took control of the Congress. We have been left with a Congress that's extremely distrustful of each other because of the political rhetoric, and we are now at a point where we require real sitting down and determining.
Do you think that's really going to happen, considering the fact that we've been waiting and waiting committee to come to a conclusion that would help the country? So what happens next?
Well, what I'd like to see happen is I'd like to see the Senate stand up and put a budget on the table and actually pass a budget. I'd like to see a coming together of the House and the Senate then to determine what the overall budget's going to be, and so that we could come to a point where we have what's called the reconciliation process, where we could in fact look at these big issues in the standard format.
So what you're saying is that you believe we should move the clock back to when you were in office and the way the Congress operated then, and not now.
I wasn't entirely satisfied with it then.
But
the fact is that if you maintain what we call, what Norm and I often refer to as regular order, there are in fact processes in place for allowing compromise to take place. When you peel off and do, and I regard the super committee as a gimmick. When you peel off and you do gimmicks as your way of governing, you are always going to end up at the end with a disaster.
No,
I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that this isn't just a process failure. We're losing the Jerry Costellos. We're losing a lot of people who were in the middle. We're moving further to extremes. We still have some in the Senate, and there's still, I hold out some hope. When you get people like Mark Warner and Saxby Chambliss and Mike Crapo and Dick Durbin coming together as the Gang of Six did, we've got some hope. You've got some people in the House, even those who are at the polls, like Mike Simpson of Idaho, who came out and said, we've got a compromise. But beyond the fact that we're seeing the changes in members, the money system, post-Citizens United and even before that, the rise and dramatic expansion since Bob was in Congress of the partisan media creating a kind of echo chamber and dividing us further and moving us to a point where you have people who don't even share a common set of facts. The growing level of tribal warfare, which has hit Capitol Hill but is leaching out into the rest of the country and states as well, all of this is different than it was a decade ago. And the reason we don't have the regular order, some of it is in what Bob said, but some of it is because our culture has moved in a direction that makes it much harder to find a center, even though there is a center in the country.
Neftali, how much does Grover Norquist play into this entire failure scenario?
Well, he certainly played hugely into the rhetoric. I mean, the Democrats really started pointing fingers at him and at his pledge. And you even had a situation where some Republicans were starting to publicly repudiate the pledge and say, look, I made it a long time ago. It shouldn't tie my hands. And then, of course, Norquist, who's not shy, came out and said, you know, of course, the pledge is binding and it'll be binding forever. So, I mean, I think it did play into this. You know, as Mr. Walker said, Republicans believe that raising taxes is a bad idea, regardless of Grover Norquist. But when you have a guy out there who's made you sign a pledge, I shouldn't say made you, but encourage you to sign a pledge and swears to hold you to account and to make a big deal of it if he thinks you're violating that pledge.
A big deal in what sense?
Well, if you know, when he feels that somebody's violated the pledge, he's very public about it. And it makes it a lot easier, for example, to have a primary challenger in the Republican Party. And so there's a certain amount of political peril in deviating from that pledge.
But just to make a point, Grover has been around for 20 or 25 years. And we have gone through periods when we have managed to do real policy and so on. So all of a sudden to say that Grover is the real problem. I mean, the AARP is out there saying don't touch Social Security in any way. You can't tell me that the Democrats don't pay attention to that.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Norm, what difference has Grover Norquist made?
It's been a big, big difference. Now, it is true that he's been around for a long time. But here again, I come back to the echo chamber and the rise of the other partisan media. Grover has taken this, and then you throw in Rush Limbaugh, and you throw in the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and you throw in a lot of others, not the news section, the editorial page, and it creates intense pressure on the members. And as Naftali said, they're all more worried about primary challenges now. And that includes senators worried about the Bob Bennett effect of being bounced from even being able to run for your party's nomination because you don't have enough fealty to the tribe. So Grover is a key player, but it's not just Grover Norquist.
There was this sort of almost poignant thing that happened in the middle of all this, where about 150 lawmakers of both parties and both chambers got together and said, we want a big compromise, and we're willing to compromise on the things that we believe in because we think reaching a deal is very important. And they had these press conferences, and it was almost cognitive dissonance to watch because you had Republicans and Democrats, instead of attacking each other, kind of saying nice things about each other. And they wanted to exert this countervailing pressure on the committee to reach a deal against the people on either side. And they tried hard, and they failed. And it was a remarkable thing to see, but ultimately they couldn't overcome the prevailing political dynamics.
And that's the reason why I believe that if you get back to a regular order process that allows those people to have a voice inside their committees, inside the houses as a whole, that you will in fact begin to move in the direction that is the right
How
direction.
How likely are we to get back to that point?
Well, I will tell you that John Boehner has certainly been working to try to do that. He has opened up the process far more than it was opened under Speaker Pelosi. I believe that there is an effort here to bring back some regular order in the process.
Norm.
I wish that John Boehner had some backup from his own leadership team, starting with Eric Cantor. But along with that, there is a move now from some of this group of 145 to bring up the Simpson-Bowles plan and get an up or down vote. And that, I think, could be the most interesting dynamic here. You got to get leaders who are willing, gutsy enough to make that happen.
How many Republicans, how many Democrats?
Well, it was 100 House members and 45 senators who basically said, bring this up. And they were fairly evenly divided. It was somewhat more Democrats than Republicans. But I think, frankly, if you brought the Simpson-Bowles plan up for an up or down vote, it passes the Senate easily. The House becomes a little more problematic, but you're going to get half the Democrats, a little bit more, and close to half the Republicans, and we might be able to make that happen. Now, whether it comes up for a vote, not likely.
How likely?
Well, I think there's going to be growing pressure to do that. I think the leaders are going to resist it, but I think it's something that could happen. You know, and there are people who say that the failure of the committee will force Congress to go back to what Mr. Walker was saying, to the way it, you know, is supposed
it
to be doing.
It used to be.
Yeah, there are people who view the failure of the committee as not the worst thing in the world because they say it'll force Congress to do the job the way it was meant to be done.
Let's bring the Simpson-Bowles plan up. Let's have some hearings on it in the committees and so on.
Haven't there been enough hearings?
Well, no. Hearings are a part of the process of beginning to bring people together, to having them understand the details so that you can get compromise and so on. That's the reason why they're there. And I think you ought to go through that process and then move it forward.
Former Republican Congressman Bob Walker, Pennsylvania, Neftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal, Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute. Watch this space. If Simpson-Bowles comes up again, I want you all back here. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from